listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been 40 years since the fall of Saigon, but the legacy of the Vietnam War is still a major part of the lives of many of the people who fought in it. Ron Stray Dog Hall is one of them, and every year the tattooed, leather-wearing Missouri Trailer Park operator joins fellow veterans for a pilgrimage on their Harley-Davidsons to the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C. His journey, full of complicated emotions, a mix of patriotism, empathy, and guilt, is captured in a new documentary called Stray Dog that opens this Friday at the Eleanor Bunin Monroe Theater at Lincoln Center. It's director Deborah Granin. Granick is best known for the critically acclaimed Winter's Bone. I'm very pleased to welcome her and Ron Stray Dog Hall to our show today. Hello. Welcome. And
Thank
Ron,
you. Thank you. Hello.
Ron, you're in Branson?
I am, yes.
So does that mean you used to go to Boxcar Willie shows?
Oh, I go to some of the shows, yeah. There's some good ones here.
Where does the name Stray Dog come from?
Oh, many years ago, I was at a biker's meet. We camped out overnight. And there was a little old stray dog. He showed up wanting to find him something to eat, you know. And there was a lady stitcher. A stitcher is a person that sews patches on your vest, sitting at the table. At the end of the table was a 55-gallon drum the guys were throwing the garbage in after they ate. Well, the dog come up there, and I guess the fella thought he would impress the lady or something. You know, he's going to run and kick that dog and run it off. And I got in front of him. It's like, no, brother, we ain't going to do this. You know, I mean, think about it a little bit, man. That dog ain't no different than I am. I don't think he's any different than you, not really. I mean, you know, the guy's hungry. He wants something to eat. He's thirsty. He wants something to drink. He wishes he had a place to go where people would let him in. He wished somebody gave a damn about him. You know, he'd like to find a mate down there. And he ain't no different than me, and I don't think he's that much different than you, you know. So the guy backed off, and I fed the dog, and I woke up the next morning, and that was sewed on my vest.
Although nobody calls you Stray Dog, but you seem to...
Oh, yeah, everybody calls me Stray Dog.
They do?
Yes, they do.
You seem to be collecting stray dogs all along during the course of this film, people who seem to be lost. That seems to be one of a mission that you have given yourself.
Well, it's just who I am, man. You know, it just fits me. I mean, I'm a product of my creator, product of my God, and a product of my past environment, and this is where life has led me. And the name seemed to kind of fit. I mean, you know, I took off, lived on the road about all 9 years, just me and my dog, and, you know, kids run away when they're young. I decided to wait until I was around 50 before I ran away, but I did, just... went out and did what I did. You know, me and my dog, we did pretty good together. Nobody else had any use for me. And the name just seemed to kind of fit. But, I mean, I got no complaints.
Well, we hear your dog in the background. Deborah,
yeah.
This film is quite different from your last project, Winter's Bone. Your first documentary?
You know, I view myself as someone who's always in the process of documenting, and I involve that practice in narrative filmmaking. But, you know, it really grew very, very organically. Ron was someone who contributed to Winter's Bone, a narrative fiction, and it was really a huge pleasure and so much to think about and look at to then sort of follow him to his real-life nonfiction setting.
So do the two kinds of filmmaking inform each other?
I feel they do. I feel that when you go someplace, especially if you're going to make any film outside of the world you know, outside of the small zip code that you're born into, you've got to involve sort of the practice of anthropology. You have to get details from people who have lived the life.
And I suspect that there were all sorts of surprises. How aware were you of the complications of Ron's story? It starts off feeling like it's going to be one thing, and then we discover it's quite different.
Well, Ron manages, you know, to make his life flow, and I would say, Ron, that you managed to complicate your life suddenly by, you know, he had been in a trailer isolated for many, many years. He complicates his life by falling in love with a woman on the other side of the border in Mexico, and all of a sudden his life is very different in a very short time. So I didn't know that going into it. I didn't know that Ron was going to start to gallop in a particular direction, and I'm not sure how much he knew, in those moments, what was going to lie ahead. Do we ever?
Well, how much he was going to reveal about the complicated story that he brings from Vietnam. Ron, how did you feel when Deborah approached you about making a movie?
I don't really know that I really felt anything in particular about it. Nothing in life surprises me anymore. But I didn't want to go make a fool out of myself, and I was a little bit hesitant at first, you know. Now, she approached me very professional, very ladylike, and asked me if I'd heard about the movie that they were making. I told her I had. She asked if I'd be interested in trying out for a part. It's kind of like, you know, girl, I ain't no actor, you know. But she gave me confidence, and I asked her to come look at my motorcycle. She did, and if you want to compliment a biker, you say, man, that's a nice ride you got, or something like that, you know. And we just kind of established a rapport there, and working with her, she was quite adamant in that it's not one person that makes this happen, you know, it's the whole crew. And I got to respect somebody who admits things like that when they're in the kind of position she is in. I mean, she's the boss. You don't mess with Deborah, you know, but she gives credit to the little folks that, help behind the scenes. They bring the catering food out, the people that have to edit the film, the people that don't never get any public exposure. But they're part of making all this thing, and it takes a whole team effort. And just becoming part of the team is, I mean, I'm a team player. I'm military. You know, we don't survive alone. No man is an island. And it just, you know, we did a movie.
And where were you getting back to Vietnam? Where were you deployed? How long were you there? And were you involved in many firefights along the way?
I was involved in firefights, yes. I have been in battle. I have been wounded in battle. And I ain't crying about it. A lot of guys got wounded less. And a lot of guys got wounded more. You know, I mean, I've been in battle more than some, less than others. So I guess I'm kind of in the middle of the road there, but I've been enough to definitely know that it rewires your brain. You don't really know it rewires your brain until some years later you start looking back at the way things are for you.
What's now being called PTSD?
It's no fun at all. The best I can say about that and the way people looked at it is to simply say that I did my job. I mean, there was no pleasure in it for me. I didn't enjoy it, but I did my job.
But you also say in the film that you did things that you later feel very guilty about. I don't know how much I want to reveal here, but was that something that took a while for you to realize?
I think I realized it immediately. It just took a while to admit it.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you understand that or not.
No, I understand that. You talk about going into therapy. Were people returning from Vietnam given psychological treatment for the things that they had seen and done?
They were kicked in the butt and said, get out of here and leave me alone. That's what they were done. One day we were in the mud and the blood and the beer, bullets flying, people crying. Next day you get off an airplane, people call you baby killer, don't want no use for you, and say, don't you break nothing.
What was the first thing you did when you got back?
Oh, Lord. Well, it wasn't the first thing I did, because I had to see some people, but shortly after that, I got on a motorcycle and just rode around the country for 6 months.
Now, you had been married in Vietnam. Did you leave your Vietnamese wife back there?
I was not married in Vietnam.
Oh.
I was married in Korea.
Oh, okay.
And I brought my wife home with me. She is a very beautiful lady, very lovely lady, very articulate. She is a very good woman. But there were issues, and more my fault than anybody else's, because it's kind of like a guy who wants to go in and say, oh, man, I found Jesus, you know, I was a big sinner, and I didn't know it. It's kind of like that. I was messing things up pretty bad, but I was wise enough at the time to realize it.
I'm talking...
She wanted me to get out of the Army. I couldn't get out of the Army, because the only people I could talk to were bikers and soldiers. That's the only people wanted me around. And kind of living I was making on a motorcycle in those days ain't the kind of living a man ought to be making, if you can understand that. It's just not what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that you had PTSD?
I had never heard of PTSD. In those days, I don't think anybody had.
Well, I don't think they were even calling it that at that time.
No, they weren't.
Shell shock or...
My first tour, my first tour...
Battle fatigue.
Well, my first tour in the military was in Korea. I was 17. That's when I met my wife the first time. I mean, we didn't get married 2 years later, but that's when I met her. I went from there. I went to Germany for a few months. I did some advanced combat training, and then I went to Vietnam. I was 18 the first time I was over there, and I was 21 the second time I was over there.
And you said that in the Army you were put into a leadership position when you were far too young. You made decisions that still and always will haunt you.
People to go out and kill people. No, it's not.
Did you feel that what you were doing, the actions that you took were right at the time, that they were necessary?
I did indeed. Yes, and I still believe they were, to a very strong degree. We saved lives. I'll tell you something about battle, son. We might go over there because our country tells us to. We might go over full of pride and patriotism. We might go over with thinking we're doing the right thing and going to be heroes or what the case might be. But we go for those reasons. But that's not why we fight. We fight for each other. We fight to stay alive. I would have to tell you better than 90% of the engagements that I was in was defensive. They were attacking us. And yet we get called baby killers.
In the film, you encourage other vets to find good therapists.
Yes.
So that was an important part of your being able to come back into normal life, going through therapy?
Indeed, yeah.
Did the Army provide you with that?
Let me tell you something about, no. I didn't. I never considered it until I'd retired from the Army.
But we should give props, though, that Bob is affiliated with the VA, Bob Bronson.
Yes,
and I'll just say one thing that is really very relevant, which is that there is a very big difference with today's counseling. You know, Ron has always explained that being confronted with a white coat, with someone that was going to use real old-school shrink-style stuff, was never going to work for veterans. It had to be someone either with combat experience or with someone who had truly steep themselves in a very different mode of addressing PTSD.
A big theme in the film is adjusting to the post-combat world, the so-called civilian survival. So that's something that you really focused on in filming this.
Well, I do, but you know, the manner in which you would conform or comply with society is still different for us. I mean, you've seen the documentary. You've seen my lifestyle. That is a lifestyle that works for us. Now, in terms of mainstream society, I probably never have and never will adapt to what most folks would call proper, you know, or mainstream society. No, we don't particularly fit there, but we fit with each other. For many years, each other's all we had. You know, I am proud to say that I'm part of the greatest brotherhood this country has ever known, because it takes a vet to bring a vet home.
But you say in the film, old men who have money start wars, young men who don't have money go fight the war. Was that something you felt all along?
If I'd have thought about it, I would say, yeah, I would have felt that and realized it. But I never really considered that before. I mean, you know, I was raised watching John Wayne and war movies. I'd dig holes in my mama's backyard, used to in Kansas, a hand grenade. I always wanted to be a soldier. So the very idea of you know, losing your patriotism because somebody with money is making you go out and murder, it just never dawned on me at that point. These are things that come along a little later when you get a little older, a little wiser, a little more beat down.
Now, do you lose your patriotism because you go on these pilgrimages to the Vietnam War Memorial, and the whole process with the flags and the reading of the names and everything feels very patriotic?
Oh, it is patriotic. I will not lose my patriotism. I don't think any of us will ever lose our patriotism, but our ideal of patriotism might be a little different than other people's. You know, I'm not being patriotic to my government. I'm being patriotic to my Constitution.
Now, Deborah, you say making a documentary is a humbling experience. How so? Do you feel like you've achieved what you set out to do with this film?
It's humbling because there's very little control over what is going to actually be recordable by your camera. You know, even the humbleness, honestly, of trying to keep up with a convoy of bikes on U.S. interstates, very humbling. You know, Ron took great care not to leave us in the dust, but he could have lost us at any time. We could not. He mounts his bike and zips off. We've got this van and this gear, and we're encumbered, and we're slow. But some of it's just logistic humbleness, right, that it's hard to execute. But in terms of trying to, do I feel that we achieved? We did not know. I mean, Ron embraced my asking him, could we have this extended dialogue over time and sort of record it. But we did not know, neither of us knew what that would end up being.
But you use a classic fly on the wall approach. You don't do a talking heads approach here. You don't interview Ron or any of the other people who appear in the film.
But we did interview Ron extensively, and he gave such rich, long, complicated, beautiful answers. We have a whole reel of Ron and some and his friend Whitey, and we have interviews. We have very substantial interviews. We could never figure out how to actually combine them because the live action was very compelling to us. The fly on the wall material was really exciting us when we were editing, when Victoria Stewart was editing the film. So we had this strand that's never been used of Ron sat for patiently for a long time. Alicia was interviewed in both English and Spanish, you know.
His wife.
Yes. And so we did that approach, and it turned out that the fly on the wall worked better for this film.
Now, we don't have a lot of time, but there are a couple of other things I want to address with Ron. When did you first become attracted to the biker lifestyle? Were you already doing that before you went to Vietnam?
I was. I started riding a motorcycle in 19. Actually, the first thing I rode with two wheels and a motor was an old BMX bicycle with a Maytag washing machine engine on it. And then I found an old Indian in the junkyard, and the guy helped me fix it up. But I've always been attracted to bikes, but it's different now because it's not me just riding around. You know, I tell you what, if you look and notice this, you will find that the biker community is extremely heavily populated with combat vets. And I've got a few theories on that myself. One thing I'm sure of, it's not just a theory, I'm just sure of this, is that it gives us back some of this brotherhood we had that we miss. You know, it's like an extended family. And the other thing is I think we get addicted to adrenaline and just need to do something to feel alive. You can talk about narcotics and drugs, but there's no high like adrenaline. I mean, I've been through firefights, man, where I don't even stop to think about it. Just move and emotion, and when it's over, I go sit down and shake for 20 minutes like, Jesus Christ, when it's over. Don't take time to do that when it's going on because you're going to die.
And on a motorcycle, you have that experience that you wouldn't have if you were driving a car.
Exactly. Man, we call people who drive cars, you're in a cage. We have biker meets. We will actually say on the poster, cagers are welcome, you know. But it's a different life, and it's not the same.
And there's a beautiful term that's used by Ron and his comrades, which is called wind therapy. And it is the actual full body sensation of your velocity cutting through wind and having your whole body affected by the sensation of moving quickly, you know.
Exactly. Yes.
Just one other thing, Ron. A part of the film addresses gun culture, especially in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
Do you own a weapon?
I do. I come to a point in my life where, I decided, well, I probably shouldn't have these things around. I started getting rid of them, but then I started feeling all kinds of naked and vulnerable. So, yeah, I went out and got several more. I own several weapons, and I mean no harm to nobody, no creature. I will not hunt an animal. I will not harm an animal.
Did being in the military change your views on guns and gun ownership? Did being in the military and using a weapon the way you had to change some of your attitudes about guns?
I don't know that it changed my attitude about guns. I mean, it's a tool. You know, like any other tool, it doesn't do anything you don't let it do or make it do. And I ain't going to tell you guns are not dangerous. Yeah, certainly they are. And I'm not going to get rid of mine, never. I mean, this thing about them taking from my dead cold hands, I would say that that would have to be the case with me. I don't mean no harm to nobody, but I don't intend to be pushed around.
But, you know, you've also been very clear, and I thought this was an astute point that Ron made early in the filming process, that every soldier is an expert marksman. You know,
yes.
Every soldier becomes extremely educated about the workings of the gun. Some become even mechanically adroit at fixing or loading, repairing, altering a gun. So we have a culture, because we have a substantial warrior culture in our country, we have a very substantial part of our population that really understands guns, is very comfortable with them, and then is also very adept at using them.
Stray Dog, a film that reveals a side of America that we don't normally see, featuring Ron Stray Dog Hall, is opening this Friday at the Eleanor Bunin Monroe Theater at Lincoln Center. My great thanks to Deborah Granick, who made it, and to Ron Hall, who is the star of that film. Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for having me. My pleasure.